This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun. Hi.
Welcome back.
We're not your grandma's Bible study. And I'm Jill, not your grandma.
Zach, also not your grandma.
Or your grandpa.
I'm not your grandfather either. I guess I could be. No, yeah. I'm not old enough.
And your children are not old enough.
Nope. Not possible.
Well, in case you were curious, 23andMe is not going to let you know anything about us. So today we are going to talk about a passage in Judges 11 that is commonly known as Jephthah's vow. Or Jephthah's rash vow. We mentioned it in discussion around John the Baptist in our very first episode when we were discussing vows in the biblical world. But we're going to take a little bit of time and talk about this actual passage. So for those who are reading along, this passage is in Judges 11, specifically 29 through 40. Although the whole chapter of 11, the first part, the first 28 verses are about Jephthah's background and why he matters. So in order to do this, we're going to talk about a couple of things. First, we're going to talk about what's known as the Deuteronomistic history, of which the book of Judges is a part. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the book of Judges, sort of an overview of what's going on there. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about some critical issues that interpreters have with this particular passage, not to mention all the moral issues that many of us have with this particular passage.
Yeah.
So the Deuteronomistic history is a long-winded way of saying conquest of Canaan through the fall of the Israelite kingdom. So it's covering a pretty big swath of quote-unquote history. Mm-hmm. This book, or this perspective, includes the books of Deuteronomy, as you can imagine, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings. Although Deuteronomy is not talking about the conquest stuff, it's sort of a recapitulation of Exodus, mm-hmm. Leviticus, and Numbers, which is this whole other thing, concept, which maybe someday we'll do an episode on rewritten Bible as a category. It's pretty fascinating. But Deuteronomy is sort of an example of a rewriting of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, sort of a summary fashion of that. But the Deuteronomistic history concept is this particular lens that Deuteronomy uses, right? So this idea that God punishes disloyalty and God rewards loyalty on sort of this grand national scale.
Right.
When you get to the chronicler, First, Second Chronicles, the chronicler does something similar, but on a more immediate scale. So like you have a bad king, bad things happen to the king. You have a good king, good things happen to the king. So it's more individualized than broadly national, right?
So who's the chronicler? No, I mean,
I don't know.
Can you explain? Okay. So
you tell me.
I didn't prepare for
Chronicles today.
Shop talk. No, just the if we or other people, academics, refer to the chronicler, what we're kind of talking about is this issue of redaction or editing. So with the way that the texts have kind of come down and the forms that we have and the forms that we don't have, an easy way to talk about the person behind, whether it was one person or many people, it was probably many people, but it becomes easier just to say the chronicler and refer to the books of First and Second Chronicles as this person who put these together because of the way that it looks. So just, we don't know who the chronicler is, but we use that term just to say, this is the process and effect of editing and redaction personified by a person.
And the same kind of goes for if we refer to the Deuteronomist.
Yes.
It's not an individual with a title. It is a way of talking about whoever, you know, compiled these particular texts, whether it's one person who did it all or 500 people, they shared a particular theological lens.
Mm-hmm.
which is sort of the way to talk about the deuteronomistic history. Mm-hmm. It's a theological lens.
Yep.
So these particular texts, again, Joshua, Judges, the books of Samuel and the books of Kings, mm-hmm. they illustrate the consequences of being faithful or unfaithful to God. So they're not interested in relating facts per se, or, you know, verifiable facts or what really happened. A way to kind of understand this is, so you've got this idea that, you know, bad things happen to bad people, good things happen to good people, and it's related on if you're faithful or unfaithful to God. But by the time we get to, like, Job is really contesting that idea of, you know, just being faithful is right. So we even see within the canon itself this tension of trying to understand stuff. And part of why this theological lens sort of develops is because these particular books are written or compiled in exile. Mm-hmm. So the people of Southern Kingdom, Judah,
yes,
are exiled to Babylon. Or is it the Northern Kingdom?
No. The exile to Babylon is Judah.
I'm so glad I'm remembering stuff correctly. Okay. So Judah's conquered. People are exiled. And they're in exile trying to make sense of, how in the heck did this happen to us? We are God's chosen people. Why are we in this predicament? Mm-hmm. How did somebody defeat our God?
Yeah.
And the way that they're making sense of this is, we must have been unfaithful. This must have been a punishment for our people. And if we can only return to a place of faithfulness, we'll be delivered. And that's what you see in the prophets, calling for this return to faithfulness on a national scale. And so we also see this in the Maccabees. There's, I think it's 2 Maccabees, the scene where the mother watches her 7 sons being martyred. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a couple of them who say things like, you know, we sinned and we brought this on ourselves kind of thing. But it's interesting to me that the person who's being punished is somebody who's clearly being faithful unto death to their God, saying, I deserve this because I've been unfaithful. And so it's really a theological way of making sense. And you still get it in certain religious contexts here in the States. I mean, I hear people say, somebody must be living right whenever, you know, something good happens or like something bad happens. Yeah. Like, okay, what have I been doing wrong kind of thing?
Yeah.
As if there's this one-to-one correlation. So it's not new that we do it now. This is a way of making sense of stuff for a very, very long time. So they're not interested in relating facts about what happened per se. And they interpret the life of the people and nations to show, one, who God is, and two, why the Israelites as a people could end up in the predicament of exile. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so these particular texts, they work to answer several questions. So how can they believe the God of Abraham, who promised a land and swore to be in covenant? How can they believe in that God when they're in exile? Mm-hmm. Has God been unfaithful, or have we been unfaithful? And what has happened to the promises and the covenant that God made with the ancestors? And also, how powerful, like I mentioned, how powerful can a God be if the Babylonians can defeat God's people? Because in the ancient world, it wasn't, you know, Babylonian army versus Judean mm-hmm. army. It was Babylonian God versus Yahweh. You know, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And so it's not just, you know, sometimes people go to war and we lose. It's, we thought we had the biggest, baddest God and we lost. Mm-hmm. So is there a bigger, badder God out there? And taking another step back, ancient Israelites didn't believe in only one God. They worshiped only one God. Yes. There was definitely, I mean, otherwise this, when, you know, God says, you shall worship no other gods before me, for I am a jealous God. That doesn't make sense if he's the only God, because there's, who can you be jealous of? So there really is this idea that there are multiple gods, that the God of the Israelites is the only one worthy of worship. Mm-hmm. The rest are chopped liver. So the exile becomes, in this theological lens, through this theological lens, one of the contractual penalties of covenant relationship. So when you're born into this Hebrew-Israelite community, you're born into the covenant. Mm-hmm. You're not earning your way into the covenant. That's a really weird understanding of what's happening. You're born, you're under the covenant. Those promises apply to you from the get-go because of the accident of your birth. Mm-hmm. But there are consequences if you violate your side of the covenant. So you're born into this contract that you didn't really have any say over. And if you violate said contract, then there are consequences for that. But you're not earning your way in, but you can earn your way out, if you will. So the exile is understood as a contractual penalty. But returning to God, aka becoming faithful again, will result in their rescue. All of these stories together tie together the cult. I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean the
religion,
the religious activity itself, military conquest, the presence of God, God's words through the prophets. So there's a lot of stuff kind of converging in all of these texts. And then we have the Book of Judges within all this. So general structure of the Book of Judges, just briefly, chapter one describes, it's a description of an incomplete conquest. Joshua makes these sweeping claims that, you know, they got into Canaan and they annihilated the people and they settled and, you know, they got it handled. Judges describes continued warfare with the Canaanites and other tribal groups like the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the Philistines. The Philistinites. So there's this incomplete conquest that happens. Chapters 2 through 16 demonstrate this recurring pattern of disloyalty to God, resulting in oppression by enemies, which results in Israel crying out in repentance, which results in God sending a deliverer, rinse and repeat.
It happens
over and over and over and over. And then chapters 17 through 21, Israel descends into idolatry, bloodshed, and civil war. We talked about the instigation of that with the murder of the woman married to the Levite man,
yep,
who is gang raped all night, left to die on a doorstep, and then is dismembered by her husband and sent to all the tribes of Israel. Horrific story. And that's sort of the pinnacle of how bad things got. So it's definitely not a story of like praise. And that's why you need to remember what you're reading when you read it. Because if you're not an educated reader and you go to some of these stories, you might think the text is saying, good job. You know, like we can dismember women and it's cool. Like it's saying no, like this whole situation was such a horrific situation. Not just, I mean, hospitality seems to be the underpinning thing. She's a casualty of misuse of hospitality. And so her death itself is not the pinnacle, but the whole situation of which her death is a part is the pinnacle. So again, Judges is written, compiled during the exile. This whole story covers about a 410-year span narratively and between like 1200 and 1020 BCE, sort of this, you know, late Bronze Age through Iron One period is the setting of the story, not when it was written, the setting of the story. The book presents these judges as successive in nature. They were likely more localized heroes. They probably overlapped. Then the stories of them grew and somebody kind of compiled them into a cohesive linear narrative. And the cyclical pattern of disloyalty, oppression, repentance, deliverance really works to reinforce the point of theological perspectives, like get it right with God, right? And so the four potential stages that scholars have for the Book of Judges are various stories of local crises and leaders coming from specific tribes. So these stories of Judges present the tumultuous time when the lineage system was transitioning into an agrarian territorial state. These stories were collected for didactic purposes, that is teaching purposes, perhaps by the mid 8th century BCE. Examples of good leaders alternate with not so good leaders, right? And then these stories get incorporated into this Deuteronomistic historian theological lens. And then after the destruction of the nation of Judah, the historical framework of these stories was sort of updated for those who were living in exile. So big themes of the book, obviously, disloyalty to the covenant and idolatry results in punishment. Repentance leads to deliverance. And God uses imperfect persons to accomplish God's will. There are 12 judges, of which one is a woman, Deborah. Someday we'll talk about Deborah. And then, and a judge. So Jephthah is considered a judge. And in our context, a judge is somebody who's making like judicial decisions.
Right.
That's not what a judge is in the Book of Judges. It's more of a deliverer, leader, I don't know.
Like a war king adjudicator. Like
war team adjudicator, yeah.
Like they're kind of, it's a weird mix of a lot of different roles all together.
So the noun judge occurs only twice, and I didn't note here if I meant that in the whole Hebrew canon or if only in Judges. So Anyway.
I will look that up real quick.
We'll find out. So the noun judge occurs only twice, but the verb to judge is attributed to all of the so-called judges, emphasizing a temporal action. So it's not a, it's not like a lifelong appointment to the judicial court of the Israelites kind of thing. It's you're raised up to judge for a while and then you go back to your life. So the two occurrences of the noun judge in the book are at 2:16:19, introducing the judges overall, and then in 11:27 in reference to God as a universal judge. So all that to say, enter Jephthah. So Jephthah has a pretty rough beginning. He's noted as being the daughter of a sex worker. And so chapter 11 is the chapter that we're going to focus on here. And this is, again, the story of Jephthah and his vow and the consequences of his vow for his only child, his daughter. So though we're not going to talk in any real way about verses 1 through 28, I'll do a little bit of an overview of this. So Jephthah is described in this passage here as, in the positive, as a mighty warrior. He is going to deliver his people from the Ammonites. And there are going to be some real consequences for that. But his description, other than that, is really quite negative. So he's noted as being the son of a sex worker and his father's unnamed. So his whole lineage is really in question, which in this particular society is...
Not good. you don't want that.
Yeah. I mean, at the very least, he's an illegitimate child. Yes. If he's a child of a sex worker. And that's problematic. He's described as being the friend of worthless fellows. And he's really not wanted by anybody to help participate in this war until it kind of gets really bad. And then they're like, okay, let's go get him, because they just didn't want him around. He was sort of a wrong side of the tracks kind of guy. In a stereotypical way, not necessarily. I mean, I think he ends up being a real douche canoe, so maybe he was always this way, but he's not, it's not particularly any qualities of him, his character, that get people to not like him. It's his background, his lineage, mm-hmm. where he comes from, that makes him unworthy. And this is part of that whole idea that God uses surprising people to deliver the rest of God's people. So he's really an ambiguous hero. And one of the texts, that secondary text that brought this particular passage up, kind of resurrected it into life again, is the work of Phyllis Tribble in her small volume, Texts of Tarot. It's a slim volume. I didn't mean little, like in a diminutive, like her little work. It's a powerful, powerful read. It's about 115 pages, if that. And it covers four different stories in the biblical text that are particularly terrifying for women. She covers Hagar, Tamar, the unnamed woman of Judges 19 that we've discussed before, and then the daughter of Jephthah here. And she really brings to light some of the rhetorical aspects of the narrative. So she's doing feminist reading of the text, paying attention to women in the text and the consequences of men's actions on these women in the text, but she's also doing a literary reading and following this text really closely. And what is the text itself saying, rather than what do I want it to say? And so she really brings up that he's just not well liked to begin with. But one of her critical issues, well, let me step back. So, you know, Jephthah goes to war, and then there's this part where, you know, the spirit of the Lord in verse 29 comes upon Jephthah, and in response to this sort of free gift of the spirit coming on Jephthah, so God choosing to anoint Jephthah in a way for this particular battle, Jephthah says, well, no, I'm going to make a vow. I have to make a promise, because I can't just have something for free. And he says, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whoever comes out of my doors, out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return victorious from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, to be offered up by me as a burnt offering. So he makes his promise to God in response to basically already being given the gift that's going to win him the war. He's got the spirit of God upon him.
Yeah.
He's going to win. And then he backtracks and says, no, I got to make a promise. And then he defeats the Ammonites, and he goes home. And when he arrives home, the first person to greet him, the first thing to greet him is his daughter. And she comes out with timbrels and with dancing, which is a really sort of common way to celebrate victory in these times. So Tribble mentions that, you know, we have Miriam and the prophet Miriam doing this after they walk across the dry land, you know, with the water on either side through the Reed Sea. And then after David returned from slaying the Philistines, it says in 1 Samuel 18 that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with timbrels, with songs of joy and instruments of music. So this is not, shouldn't be understood as an unusual thing that his daughter's coming out to greet him in this way. This is a really typical response to war victory, or to victory at the hands of God, as it's understood. And so this becomes a point of contention for interpreters, with this question coming up of, did Jephthah know his daughter would be the first one to walk out, and he still made this promise?
Yeah.
Or did he think maybe the cat would get out the door first, kind of thing? You know, I mean, I don't know if he had a cat, but probably not. The goat would break free first and greet him. Or, you know,
yeah.
Did he have a life partner he didn't particularly care for very much and thought maybe she would like walk out first and be like, awesome, I can kill this woman and get rid of her. Who knows? So that is really a question that interpreters wrestle with is, did Jephthah know she would be the first one? And if so, what a monster. But then there's this response in the text when she comes out to greet him of like sort of typical mourning. He rents his clothes. Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You have become the cause of great trouble to me. For I've opened my mouth to the Lord and I cannot take back my vow. I mean, he really does just blame her.
Yeah.
For doing something pretty standard. Such a way that people, you know.
Well, and it's compounded too by the fact that Mosaic law, which obviously wasn't being observed during this time, forbades human sacrifice. So, you know, it's just kind of like at this point, you've got a guy who doesn't need to make a rash vow on a topic or, you know, using materials, so to speak, human bodies as your payment, and then gets to this point where he blames the very thing that he probably expected, that, you know, the person that he expected to be there.
Or that he could have reasonably expected.
Yeah. It's not like he wouldn't have thought that she wouldn't have been there. Yeah.
Right. Which, and so it really is this very, very, very problematic vow that he makes and the consequences that he seems to take to its most literal conclusion. And so whenever he says, whoever comes out of the doors to meet me in verse 31, the Hebrew text really doesn't identify in that word species or gender of the intended victim, whoever. And so you might be expected to think that an animal
could be
the first thing that comes out, since animals were typically kept in the courtyards of homes.
Yeah.
So the first thing you see, but this, there's just ambiguity in this text. And so when you first hear this, I mean, imagine that you've never heard the story before and you just hear this guy's going to war. He makes promise like, I'm going to make a sacrifice to you. Whatever the first thing that I encounter when I get home, that's yours. And that sort of first fruits notion is kind of common in sacrifices. You know, you've got to sacrifice the firstborn that opens the womb kind of thing of all your animals, first fruits of your harvest, go to God. And so the idea that he would say the first thing doesn't seem that bizarre to me, but the fact that it's his daughter and that he doesn't, I mean, he just takes his, I think that anybody would be like, well, I mean, obviously you didn't mean your daughter kind of thing, your only daughter. So the drama is even there heightened, like she's his one and only child. So when she dies without children, his line is ended. And then this patrilineal, really androcentric society, that is a consequence that he has to live with. And I don't want to make this about him. I don't want to feel sorry for him at all. But it's very big. So he goes and he blames her. You've brought me very low. You're the cause of great trouble for me. Like, no, dude, your own mouth is you're the cause of great trouble
for you. You did it to yourself.
And her response is, my father, if you have opened your mouth to the Lord, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, now that the Lord has given you vengeance against your enemies, the Ammonites. Then she says, let this thing be done for me. Grant me 2 months so that I may go and wander on the mountains and bewail my virginity, my companions and I. And he says, go. Sends her away for 2 months. She leaves with her companions to bewail her virginity on the mountains. At the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to the vow he had made. And then the narrator says she had never slept with a man. She'd never known a man. So there arose an Israelite custom that for four days every year, the daughters of Israel would go out to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite. So sort of the story that's happening here, this big twist sort of at the end. So one of the critical issues for Phyllis Trible is this idea of Jephthah's unfaithfulness here. So she reads, and I tend to agree with her, when God puts a spirit on Jephthah, and then his response is to sort of barter for the win, for the victory, as opposed to just trusting, that's an unfaithful move.
Mm.
That God giving something freely and then Jephthah responding with, nope, I'm going to give you something back, is sort of it's a power move almost on Jephthah's part. Mm-hmm. And so she finds it particularly problematic that by the time we get to the book of Hebrews, where Jephthah is named in Hebrews 11, I believe, in sort of these great men of faith, you know, she's really just troubled by the idea that his unfaithfulness that seems so clear in the actual Judges narrative, for the author of Hebrews, it's being totally reframed as faithfulness.
Yeah.
And it's just really, really problematic. So she writes about his unfaithfulness. The making of the vow is an act of unfaithfulness. Jephthah desires to bind God rather than embrace the gift of the Spirit. What comes to him freely, he seeks to earn and to manipulate. The meaning of his words is doubt, not faith. It is control, not courage. To such a vow, the deity makes no reply. And so that for her is a really just problematic way that even within the larger canon, a Christian canon, if you will, Jephthah's act becomes this great act of faith. And at the time, it's really quite cowardly.
Mm-hmm.
It's really manipulative. And then a second issue that she has is 11:39, the last part of it. So there arose an Israelite custom, or it became a tradition. It's another common way it's translated. So she notes that the verb here, or sorry, the pronoun here, it, is the verb clause of the whole thing is in the singular form of to be or to become. So Hebrew doesn't really have a neuter general. Neuter gender.
The neutered general.
The neutered general. Jephthah? I don't know. Freudian slip. So since the Hebrew has no neutered gender, such feminine forms, so the feminine singular form of be or become in this particular phrase, might carry a neuter reading, or which would be the traditional, you know, it became.
Sure.
And that's certainly a legitimate reading.
Yeah.
Phyllis Trible doesn't want to discount that. She said, but it may not be perceptive.
Right.
Indeed, grammar, content, and context provide, and this is Trible I'm quoting here, compelling reasons for departing from this translation. After all, the preceding clause has she as the subject of the verb. Now, she had not known a man. An independent feminine pronoun accents the subject. Similarly, the feminine grammatical gender of the verb become may refer to the daughter of herself. So the term that is usually designated custom can also mean tradition. So the resulting translation with these nuances in place would be she became a tradition in Israel, not it, not the act that happened to her, but the woman herself, which I think is really, really quite beautiful. Contra Phyllis Trible, Cheryl Exum is writing in a book called Judges and Methods. She does a chapter on feminist criticism in Judges. And so she has a brief little two-page excursus here on excursus, two-page section.
Side note
on Bat Jephthah. And she argues for a translation of she became an example in all of Israel. And if That is the translation that you choose. This would suggest widespread support for her willingness to be sacrificed. And, you know, XM has problems with that because it sounds like sort of support for this androcentric patriarchic community, and how women can just become victims all the time. And then, but she also notes that there is within the text some resistance by the daughter to what her father says. And I kind of stressed it when I said it earlier. She responds to her dad getting mad at her by saying, "My father, if you have opened your mouth to the Lord, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth." Mm. She resists him blaming her.
Right.
In a way of putting it back on him, because he says, you know, "You've brought me low. You've caused me such trouble." And she's like, "Well, if you said this thing, then you do what you said you were going to do. Don't put me in this." And so in that way, she's not quite as willing. Mm-hmm. You know, she's resisting it in some ways. And then a couple of notes on how people have interpreted Jephthah and his daughter in the same Judges and Methods book on David Gunn's chapter on cultural criticism. He looks at different visual interpretations of the daughter and the sacrifice, or the meeting in family Bibles through the 18th and 19th centuries. But he's got this little bit where he talks about how interpreters have talked about this passage. So one response was to praise the daughter. Mm. You know, she's a model of purity and obedience, selfless devotion to the father. So Matthew Henry sums it up this way. He says, "The story magnifies the law of the fifth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother, by teaching, quote, that it well becomes children obediently and cheerfully to submit to their parents and the Lord, and particularly to comply with their pious resolutions for the honor of God and the keeping up of religion in their families, though they be harsh and severe, as Jephthah's daughter here, who for the satisfying of her father's conscience and for the honor of God and her country, yielded herself as one devoted." So you can see here that there's sort of this interesting interpretation of the fifth commandment with the disregard for the commandment. Granted, it's not in the top 10, although "thou shalt not kill," "thou shalt not murder" is up there, but human sacrifice is forbidden.
It's forbidden.
And then there's sort of this patriotism that's wrapped up in it for love of God and or for honor of God and her country. So it's really fascinating the way that he praises her. Oh, Alfred Tennyson writes, "How beautiful a thing it was to die for God and my sire," she exclaims, and is comforted by the thought that she subdued herself to her father's will, "because the kiss he gave me ere I fell sweetens the spirit still." Reverend John Howard assures his young readers, he was a preacher in the United States, that her cheerful resignation deserves imitation because they should all be ready to submit to the will of their parents. Harriet Beecher Stowe, this is interesting, writes, she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. She writes that this passage has set before us a high and lovely ideal of womanhood in the Judean girl. There's but a sentence, yet what calmness, what high-mindedness, what unselfish patriotism are in the words, "My father, if thou hast opened thy mouth to the Lord." It's really interesting.
I think it's fascinating too that, so we've got some record here of, you know, what we might call early Christian in the United States interpretation, reception, history of the story. Whereas if you look in the Talmud, like, they kick Jephthah up and down, and they're like, in Bereshit Rabbah 60:30, they criticize him for poor judgment, who makes unfitting vows without proper consideration for consequences. In, I can't actually pronounce that despite being able to say Hebrew, there's a midrash that asserts that if Jephthah had read the laws and vows in the Torah, he would have not lost his daughter. The rabbis also ascribe Jephthah's death to his actions as punishment. So he's looking at 12:7 there, that they write that Jephthah's penalty consists of the shedding of his limbs, which are buried in numerous places, as is learned from Judges 12:7. And so I think it's interesting that you've got, I mean, and that's not to say like all of Judaism, this is Talmud I'm talking about here for the most part. So there's definitely, and there's obviously Christians who are critical of Jephthah too, but right. It's interesting to see the people who want to either minimize, you know, like there's other scholars and writers who have tried to minimize Jephthah's actions in that, well, he didn't kill her. He just put her in solitary confinement for the rest of her life.
And that's one of the ways to get around this is that line where he says, you know, whoever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return victorious from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's to be offered up by me as a burnt offering. There is a conjunctive there that I think is typically read as "and to be offered up," but it can be read as "or to be offered up." And so because her actual death is not recorded, it just says Jephthah did to her as his vow required kind of thing. If you read it as a optional conjunctive there of "or to be offered up," then it is she will be dedicated to the Lord or it will be sacrificed. Mm-hmm. So if it's a human, then she's yours. Mm-hmm. And if it's an animal, then I'm going to kill it and it's yours. And so that's how some have sort of softened this whole story. But I don't want to say before we wrap up here that the praise of the daughter didn't come hand in hand with criticism of Jephthah.
Right.
So Matthew Henry again writes, "Most condemn Jephthah. He did ill to make so rash a vow, and worse to perform it. He could not be bound by this vow to that which God had forbidden by the letter of the sixth commandment, 'Thou shalt not kill.' God had forbidden human sacrifices, so that it was, in effect, a sacrifice to Moloch." Another often quoted discussion from 1725 says, "Nobody can read Jephthah's vow and the execution of it without horror and amazement." So there is this simultaneous praise of the daughter for her submission to this vow that is rightly and simultaneously criticized. Mm-hmm. And so that feels like such a fine line to be walking, because the daughter should have criticized the vow too. Like, if we can notice how problematic it is, she shouldn't be praised for being such a submissive, willing, calm follower of this thing that has happened. I think we're better to read what she says as saying, fine, you do what you said you were going to do. Like, don't put this on me. And then the last thing I'll note here is that this word for virginity, "let me go bewail my virginity," doesn't have anything to do with her sexual experience.
Nope.
It has to do with her being of marriageable age.
Right.
And so it's a misleading translation. So she's saying, "let me go and bewail that," like, this, I mean, maybe in a sense, "that I'm never getting out of your house," kind of thing. Because she would be going to live with a partner. Perhaps she was betrothed and she's going to bewail that she wouldn't get to be with somebody that she wanted to be with, maybe. Or, you know, it's such a critical juncture that this is happening in her life. And so I think that's important to note, so that when the narrator makes this comment of "she never slept with a man," those are two different things that are being said. One is she's of marriageable age, and then the other is, and she was not sexually experienced. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's a misleading translation, so just note that. And then, you know, my critical issue with this particular story, of many issues I have with it, one of them is that we see this connection between these wars that men fight and how it impacts individual women's bodies over and over again. Not just, I mean, there is definitely an aspect where the war of Jephthah and his troops versus the Ammonites affects Ammonite women and probably other Israelite women. War affects everybody. But then you get these weird little stories where there's one woman involved, like one particular woman. So we saw it in Judges 19, where the body of the wife is dismembered, and the dismemberment being her dismembered body being sent to the other tribes causes the civil war. And then we see it here with military victory, and then Jephthah's daughter has to die, maybe, or at the very least be, you know, never get to marry, and, you know, is forced into some sort of religious servitude she didn't necessarily want to be in. And in another episode that we'll be doing probably next week, on Cozby in Numbers 25, we see it again, that the death of this woman results in a war between Israel and the Midianites. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really common trope I'm beginning to find. And so anybody who's listening to this, don't you dare write the book before I do, because I'm working on it. So that's a little bit about Judges and Jephthah's daughter.
What a jerk.
Judges has some real downer stuff. It's got some really cool stuff too, but it's also got a couple of the worst stories in here.
But it really does. I mean, if the whole point of the Deuteronomistic history, especially in Judges here, is to show, I can't remember, is it, might be David Janssen, who was talking about how really this is showing, kind of like with the dismembered woman in Judges 19, like the moral decline mm-hmm. that's actually happening, that it's really an inverted story of the binding of Isaac
right.
in yeah. that Isaac is rescued and there's something else that stands in the place, but there's no ram for Jephthah's daughter.
Right.
And so it's really the antithesis of that story. So it's an interesting record in yeah. that regard to
which
serve as a warning.
Commentators that I was reading all mentioned that. I just didn't bring it up. So it's, yeah, so that's out there. But it's a bummer of a story, but it is part of a bummer of a book. So intended to be a bummer of a book. I mean, that's one of the critical issues with when you're reading biblical texts, understanding what you're reading, because they're not always wanting you to side with the hero of the story. I don't think that there's anybody who's like, we should just make vows to kill our children.
Right.
After reading this. I think there's not... I mean, if anybody is interpreting Jephthah as doing the right thing here, they are doing some serious theological gymnastics to get there.
Yep. Yep.
It is a disconcerting story to everybody, but that's part of what the book of Judges is about, is look how bad things are getting. We're killing our own children. So that's one of my favorite quotes from C.S. Lewis, is he says that if you're not capable of reading books written for grown-ups, you shouldn't read them at all.
Mm.
And he's talking about people misusing the Bible for their own means. And I just kind of love this. If you don't know how to read Judges for what Judges is, and you're just going to side with Jephthah and the Levite who dismembers his woman, maybe you shouldn't read it.
Just don't read it.
Yeah. I think maybe you should like go play some video games. So, but I doubt any of our listeners are probably agreeing with Jephthah and the Levite. So, and that's it.
That's all we got.
That's all we got. Amen and Selah.